All right, both sides ready? Okay, if you'll call the case, we'll get started.
The court will now call Adele Sadiq versus the state. Appeals number 0215095CR. And may it please the court, Mr. Brent Bowie to argue for the appellate, Ms. Andrea Simmons to argue for the state.
Hey, Brent.
May it please the court. We're here on two issues today, one having to do with a phone call done in a jail, as well as a warrant blood draw done in a jail facility as well. And I'll kind of go through the way we lined our brief. The first issue that we address is the phone call. What we have here is once Mr. Sadiq was arrested, after booking, he was able to use a phone to call someone. In this case, he called his father. In this particular case, the phone was used at a desk. It was not in a jail cell. It was basically at a large desk where officers sometimes sit in a jail facility. It's undisputed that there was no prompt on the phone. In fact, it was just basically a common phone like anyone would see on an office desk. There was no sign near the phone. In fact, the evidence was there was one in the whole jail facility area. There was one sign that said that phone calls are subject to monitoring. Supposedly that sign was near a, it's confusing. Either it was at one point called a blood draw room, but the actual term that the jail called it, I believe, was a bail holding room. Basically, people were sat there to await posting bail, and that's also the room that they used for their blood draw collection room. Again, it's hard to tell from the record, I think, and how the jail facility is set out. It's a rather large jail facility with different holding cells throughout. There was some talk in the outside the presence of the jury whether or not there are phones believed to be in the jail cells that inmates can use that do have a prompt. Now the jailer himself wasn't sure when it was asked that if someone from the Frisco Police Department indicated that those do have prompts. He thought that would probably be correct if they did indicate that there was prompts. So possibly there's no prompts at all. The state and the issue that we really have on the phone call is meaningful notice. Did Mr. Sadiq have reasonable notice that his phone call, and for that matter, whether his father had meaningful notice, that his phone call was also going to be recorded? Bangerette case out of the Houston Court of Appeals, interesting that was also authored by now Justice Guzman, indicates that, again, set out the idea of a meaningful notice, that the defendant in the case needs to have meaningful notice that he's being recorded. The state relies on the issue of some cases, and in those cases it talks about a phone prompt, it talks about a sign next to the phone, it talks about signs throughout the jail facility, multiple signs, but they cited no case that says that one sign 7.5 feet in the air on a black and white sheet of paper on a white wall is meaningful notice. Because we would submit that they're not. If you look at all those cases, they're all very distinguishable because of the fact you have a phone prompt, because of the fact that you have multiple signs, or at least you have signs next to the phone indicating that it's being recorded. And again, we believe that 16.02 does apply. There's some talk in the appellee's brief about expectation of privacy. Well, the state didn't try to offer necessarily what the jailer overheard. They sought to introduce the entire conversation between Mr. Sadiq and his father. Now, we argued that issue, though there is some argument outside the presence of the jury regarding what the state tried to admit about what Mr. Sadiq said. And we argued that issue regarding the escape that they wanted to show as evidence of guilt wasn't admissible because he never attempted to escape. We cited the Hodges case, so we argued to the court saying that it's not admissible, 403 should apply. But then when we go past that to the real crux, what the state really wanted to get in was the fact that Mr. Sadiq's father asked him, "Are you intoxicated?" And he said, "Yes, I'm at Yosef's house." Now, interesting enough, the state in their brief decided to put in a transcript. That transcript's not part of the record. Obviously, we have the piece of the exhibit that was offered into evidence, but the transcript that they actually cite in their brief or put in their brief was never part of the court's record or the clerk's record in this case. There was videotape that was offered, I believe, I can't remember, by the defense of the state, but it's offered showing Mr. Sadiq walking into a jail cell where the blood draw occurred. And that's supposedly where the sign is located, is in a window, glass window, 7.5 feet in the air next to where he walked in. And you can clearly see from the videotape, he never looks up to see the sign. He's escorted by one jailer and then two other officers falling behind. And then the I don't even want to call her technician, the blood draw person who drew the blood into this room, he never looks up to see the blood draw or to see the sign regarding the phone call. So we don't believe the state at any point showed that the defendant had meaningful notice in this case.
Counsel, was the phone call after the blood draw?
The phone call, I believe, was after the blood draw.
Okay, thank you.
There's a line of cases dealing with towing cars. And we think this is far afield, but... And the statute dealing with towing cars requires that the sign be located no more than a particular height or no less than a particular height in relation to the car. And there are explanations for the reasons for that. Does that logic, that reasoning, apply at all to where the sign regarding phone calls should be? Is there any, what is the basis for requiring the sign warning a person that the phone call can be monitored? Is monitored the same thing as recorded and preserved? Now, don't keep nodding your head at us. I know, yeah, you don't know you're doing it, but you're really getting enthusiastic about this. So, We'll talk to you in a minute.
Yes, we would think that the idea of having...
But is there any statute, is there any rule that's going to tell the police department where that sign has to be in relation to the...
There's no law out there.
To the telephone.
All we can look at is guidance from the court to have said, you need to provide meaningful notice. And again, there's two separate issues here. The state went to offer the entire phone call. Not what Officer Nye or the detention officer heard. They went to offer the entire thing. So that's why you must have meaningful notice to the person, and again to the person on the other end that he's being recorded. I mean, the legislature didn't exempt jails from the wiretap statute. So
we look at the wiretap statute to see what's required by the jail?
Yes, ma'am. That's one of the things we argued to the court and we put in our brief. That we need to look at, and that's why, that's part of our argument, and that's why in the Begarrett case, the Houston Court of Appeals, that's kind of the only really, one of the main cases we have on point, talks about the only thing we have, the only law we have to go by is this, it's a 2008 case, that says you have to provide meaningful notice. And again, they had to look at federal law, some of the federal wiretap statutes to show whether or not someone was providing with meaningful notice. And in this case, the Ben-Garrett case, it actually said there was a prompt on the phone that said you may be recorded. And the court says, well, you had a prompt there that said you may be recorded. So the person, you know, had a reason to know that conversation was being recorded.
Is the record silent here, or is there affirmative evidence that there was no prompt?
There's affirmative evidence there is no prompt, and there is one sign on a wall near blood draw room.
How do we determine meaningful notice? Is that a question of law, a question of fact? Is it a...
I think it's, unfortunately, it could go both ways. I mean, I think the court, we argued as a matter of law originally, that one sign as a matter of law was not meaningful notice. There was not a prompt. There was only one sign. There was not a sign.
So is it a reasonable person standard? What would give notice to a reasonable person?
The state tried to argue that it's a reasonable person standard, and that probably has some teeth, but I think one sign is not reasonable. That's what, you know, Justice Daffino made the comment about, we have specific statutes for going to tow a car that has to be at so much feet, so visible, the print has to be so large. But so towing a car is more important than someone's constitutional rights in making a phone call in a facility. And again, it goes to both parties. Well, not Mr. Sadiq's father was also aware that what he was saying was going to be recorded as well.
Okay, so assuming that that was not meaningful notice, can you explain to us how it was harmful in this particular case, in this particular trial?
In this particular case, the father's question was, were you drunk? And he answered, yes. So it's an admission by the defendant. Now, again, so yes, it was very harmful. Because the jury could go back and say, hey, he said he was intoxicated. He said he was drunk. Guilty.
But in light of the blood test results, isn't that...
Well, that brings me to the next point, is the blood draw. Obviously, the blood draw was a very contentious issue at trial. We argued that under the Fourth Amendment reasonableness, that the blood draw was not reasonable. If you look at the cases, Schremberg, Pacheco out of this court, some of the other cases around the state, and even the Schremberg says there's two prongs. First prong is whether or not it's a reasonable test, meaning is it reasonable to do a blood draw test for DWI, and then also you have to look at the police employed reasonable means and procedures. And that reasonable procedure is deemed reasonable, at the presumed reasonable, if the state or the police use accepted medical practice to draw the blood. In this case, we pointed out not one, not two, but many issues with the blood draw. Ms. Doolittle, who was an employee, or subcontractor actually, to the Collin County in some form or fashion, in her affidavit that's admitted in trial, she indicates she was actually an employee of the Denton County District Attorney's Office and the Dallas County and the Collin County District Attorney's Office, which she later had to correct at trial. But we had two hearings about the blood draw, and by the end of the trial, on volume, I believe it's volume seven, sorry, six, volume six, page, I went black, actually, it's on the volume. I was wrong, sorry. Volume seven of the reporter's record, page 56, lines 3 through 4, it was asked of the blood draw person, "So you didn't use accepted medical standards in drawing Adil's blood?" And she answered, "Correct." So the person who drew the blood, in this case, indicated she herself did not use recognized acceptable medical procedure in drawing the blood. So we show the presumption that proper medical procedure was not used in this case, and then the state showed no evidence that the procedure used was acceptable in any form or fashion.
Does that automatically require exclusion?
Yes, under the Fourth Amendment, we would say yes. The Fourth Amendment reasonableness test should be exclusion. If we were following 724, the blood draw, a consensual blood draw, she wouldn't have been found qualified, I don't believe, under the record and how she testified, to draw the blood. But because we're going on a blood search warrant, the courts have said, wait, it's a blood search warrant, 724 doesn't apply. So we now have to look at just the totality of reasonable standard. Again, Ms. Doolittle went to some sort of technical college to draw blood. She was not employed by any type of medical facility. But in contrast, we showed evidence from a phlebotomy supervisor at the local Denton Regional Hospital who's been drawing blood for 30 years. He trains people how to draw blood. He supervises people how to draw blood. He evaluates them how to draw blood. He watched the videotape. He testified at the hearing and at trial of all the different things she did poorly or wrong and how she didn't follow any proper accepted medical procedure. Now, the state tried to then say, well, Mr. Henderson, are you aware where this is not acceptable? And he was basically like, this is the way we do it. This is the way I've been doing it for 30 years. I'm not aware of any other hospitals or any other agencies that says how she did it was acceptable. But by her own admission at trial, Ms. Doolittle said she herself did not follow proper medical procedure. So the burden shifts to the appellee, the state, to show, is it reasonable? Mr. Sadiq did not have a choice of who got to draw his blood. It's not like, you know, the cases where they didn't give a medical diagnosis. You know, they didn't tell the officer, hey, I've got this medical condition, I'm at risk of drawing blood. That's where the person holds the information. Here, the government, the appellee, holds all the information. They decide who they're going to draw the blood. They decide where the blood's going to be drawn. and they decide, that person decides what procedures they're going to use. And thank goodness there was a jail video, which funny enough turned out weeks before trial, a year and a half later, that showed the procedure that was used, or the lack of procedure that we used to draw blood. And I could understand if we point out like one thing, like the state says, well, the tourniquet was left on too long. We didn't show evidence of how that was damning. Well, that wasn't the only thing. It was the tourniquet. It was that Ms. Doodle had Mr. Sadiq lay his arm on a bench where people sit in a strange angle. That's not in a phlebotomy chair. They didn't want to move it in there. She didn't clean the site properly. Once she cleaned the site, she didn't touch the site again. So it's everything when we look at reasonableness. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. Andrea. All right, let's hear it.
All right, may it please the court, Mr. Bowen. I guess I'll start off where Mr. Bowen started, and that is addressing the notice provided at the Frisco jail at the arrest. It's true, as Mr. Bowen said, that at the time of the arrest, there was one sign, as far as testimony showed, in the area where appellant was located during the bookend process. From my understanding of the record, when you're facing the phone, the sign is behind you, 7.5 feet in the air on a glass pane above a window, above a door. And, but the time he made the phone call is the last part of the procedure of what had occurred that night. What had occurred is he had had the blood draw, and he would have gone toward the sign, underneath the sign, to enter the blood draw room. And also he had had his mug shot taken, and according to Detention Officer Nye, there would be an opportunity for a person to have viewed that sign when they're waiting for their photographs to be taken. And he also testified that a reasonable person would have seen the sign in that area.
Is that the standard?
A reasonable person?
Yes.
The standard, my understanding is fairly kind of unclear in some of the cases you look at. We really don't have much guidance within the state of Texas, other than the case cited by Mr. Bowen, which I will probably pronounce incorrectly as Banner Gent. But other than that, and they relied on a Wisconsin case. And my research also went federally looking elsewhere, trying to find cases on point. And admittedly, I had a difficult time trying to figure out exactly how everybody is interpreting the statutes.
Well, and meaningful notice, I mean, is the purpose that the defendant then consents to the recording?
Yes, Your Honor. It's an implied consent. Okay. All that's required is that there be a reasonable notice or meaningful notice given to the defendant, and that if he continues forward with making phone calls in that jail, then his consent is implied under the circumstances.
So we can look to implied consent in other situations.
Yes, Your Honor.
Such as searching cars and other Fourth Amendment situations where consent is implied to various authorities' activities.
Yes, Your Honor. I would think that would be applicable because we're, you know, the statutes in Texas are based upon the federal statutes, and Fourth Amendment is where the interpretation of these cases flow from. And so I think that that would be the appropriate place to go, in addition to starting off that expectation of privacy under the Fourth Amendment, of knowing that when they're in custody, you already start off with a lowered expectation of privacy. And so then you start from that lowered expectation of whether or not you were giving meaningful notice before you continued with making the phone call.
Would you look at other statutes dealing with adequate signage to determine what is sufficient?
I think, referring back to your example of the towing, I think there can be guidance in why there would be parameters set up as far as the signs, but that the facts are going to be different when you're looking at pulling into a parking area or a parking space and noticing the signs around you versus entering a large room area where you're going to spend a pretty good amount of time before you're able to make a phone call, because I know many of the times you enter a parking lot, it's right as soon as you enter, or it's in front of you when you pull into a space. If you're in a large room and you're sitting around waiting for officers to do the next task, often I think people are left looking around the room. And the sign at issue clearly reads that all jail calls are subject to monitoring, and I think that that language makes it appropriate.
All jail calls?
Yes, Your Honor.
You think that's notice that calling from a police officer's desk?
I believe so. I think any...
Is considered a jail call?
Yes. I believe if you're... It's notice jail calls, that if you're in the jail making a phone call, even if you're an employee, most likely you should... Every person using the phone in the jail would be on notice that their phone calls may be monitored.
Can you address the harm issue?
The harm issue, there are two main areas of concern regarding the admission of a call, which is one, the evidence of Mr. Sadiq's admission of being intoxicated, and two, the evidence of him fleeing the country, or intent to flee the country. I think the second one is the easiest to just knock out of the way, because the testimony shows that while he was making the phone call, Detention Officer Nye was standing next to him, and in fact, Detention Officer Nye testified as to what the appellant was stating on the phone. So even if you did not have the recording, you still had that testimony from Detention Officer Nye as to his comments about, my life is over, I'm just gonna leave the country, I think I'll go to Pakistan. And that's coupled with his knowledge that Mr. Sadiq was not born in the United States and was intoxicated. And so he could make the inference there that based on this intoxication arrest, he was gonna flee the country. So I think that's admissible without the recording. So the important part goes back to the confession, because the only thing Officer Nye could have heard is appellant's response. He did not testify that he could hear the father saying, were you drunk? So merely him saying yes, the officer wouldn't know what he's talking about, obviously, without the recording that had the father's question on it. As far as the harm analysis on that, the state would argue that there is so much evidence of his intoxication that would make his confession harmless. And I think that another interpretation that I didn't think of in time for my brief but thought about yesterday was even the comments that the officer heard him saying, like, my life is over, this is it, I might as well just leave, it was over, you know, it's over, I should just leave the country, we'll figure it out. That's almost similar to an admission itself. At that point, he's stating that due to this arrest for intoxication, when I'm being charged with, my life is over. I have to leave the country. It's not working out for me. This isn't good. So that's also damning information as far as his guilt for the offense that he's arrested on.
But he could feel that way whether he felt he was intoxicated or not, just based on the fact of the arrest, correct?
I believe you could. It's hard to tell what a person would be, how one would react, but I think it's an inference that can be drawn. And obviously, the detention officer and I took it seriously enough that he was speaking, the comments he were making were important enough to be transferred over to the judge and notified of for bond requirements. But there's also a lot of testimony by the arresting officer as to the driving done by Mr. Sadiq. Veering and almost hitting several cars, making an illegal right-hand turn with no signal, and then making a U-turn, red glossy eyes, which are depicted in the mugshot, which the jury also saw, unsteady on his feet, smell of alcohol, in addition to the blood test results of a 0.238. And so I think all of those combined, even absent the recording, that there was more than enough information for a fact finder to have found him guilty as charged in the indictment.
Andrea, I've got a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Was there any kind of scheduling for discovery? Because in a civil case, you've got a certain length of time to complete discovery, and then the circumstances had better be really special to be able to come up with stuff at the last minute. And this record is disturbing.
I will admit, Your Honor, the record is a mess. And there were deadlines that were set by the court. The defense had filed requests for discovery, and the trial judge had ruled on those, and the state was turning over discovery pursuant to the request. And then as time went on past those discovery limits, the prosecutors working on the case were learning of more information that they were not aware of prior, although it is their responsibility as part of the state to know what everybody else involved in the case was. There was mishaps in knowing which police agencies have cameras and don't. Do you ask every police agency, call them on every case, asking, do you have a videotape? I need a videotape. A lot of times, prosecutors rely on what the police agencies are sending to them and are telling them, we need everything. And they send things to us, and then as time goes by, something happens or occurs. Like in this instance, the defense visits the jail, and it's like, oh, there's a camera here. Is there a recording? No one would have known it had he not gone, or the prosecutor wouldn't have known it, had he not gone and then pointed it out, and then the prosecutor calls the jail and says, y'all have recordings? There's a camera? And it is disturbing. It's a lack of communication that I don't think is distinct to Denton County.
How long before jury selection did y'all turn over the recording to the defense?
I believe defense counsel, or Mr. Bowen, referred to it as the eve of trial. I think it was actually on a Saturday, if I'm correct, which would not have counted as a work day. But the prosecutor, as soon as she did get it, even though it was a weekend, emailed it to him. And the trial court then granted a continuance of 1 week to allow the defense time to prepare based on the state's late timing and giving that information over.
And what else was really late? Was it the blood results or the...
I don't believe the blood results were... I know there were another complaint about the list of witnesses who would be testifying on the behalf of the state. I guess there were multiple amendments made to it, adding new people. I think one of the what was complained of, if I recall correctly, by Mr. Bowen was the addition of the investigators from the DA's office who would be testifying as to fingerprints for prior convictions. And the judge basically said, you know, we're kind of nitpicking right now. If the state's alleged priors, you know, you can assume they're going to be bringing an investigator from their office who's going to come up here to testify to fingerprints. We do that in every case. So that's not anything that should prejudice. Should it have been included in a notice? It should have. It's required. Did it prejudice the defendant? I don't think so. This is something, like we said, it has nothing to do, pertain to the facts of the underlying case, rather just proving up the conviction for enhancement purposes. But I will admit that it was a mess, and although it was a mess in reading it, I believe that the trial court handled it accordingly and allowed the defense adequate amount of time for them to prepare based on the information that was given to them untimely. I can't say that we excuse the state's behavior. It is a difficult process, which is a continual work in progress, especially in light of Brady, on trying to make sure that we have everything. And it's a difficult progress, which is no excuse. But we do believe that it did not harm the defense in this case and that he was allowed adequate time.
And the jury instruction that they requested and didn't get?
As to the blood draw or the...
Both.
Both.
I think admissibility was contested for both of those.
Excuse me. As far as the jury instruction under 3823, you know, the law requires that you had to put forth some kind of affirmative evidence. As far as the meaningful notice, the appellant relies on a picture of a sign and a video that doesn't show him looking up. And the state would contend that that is not affirmative evidence that he did not see the sign, merely by saying we don't see him looking at the sign, therefore it's affirmative evidence he did not see the sign.
Doesn't that make it a fact issue for the jury to determine?
I think it would only be a fact issue if you had two competing. The only testimony at trial was that we are not from the state's witnesses, were that we don't know if he saw the sign. Nobody viewed him seeing the sign.
Wasn't it the burden on the state to show the lawfulness of the action, the lawfulness of the recording, the lawfulness of the blood draw?
On the blood draw, yes. I was talking about as far as
both.
The sign.
I'm talking about.
Right. On the reasonableness of the sign, is what the state's argument would be whether it was meaningful notice given to a person, not that we have to affirmatively show that he saw the sign. It's based on the surrounding circumstances, and then the consent is implied on whether or not he could have seen the sign. Because the state didn't put on any specific evidence that, yes, he saw the sign, and then they put on evidence somewhere that says, no, he didn't see the sign, that would be a fact issue. But if we just say we don't know if he saw the sign, and they say, well, we can't show you a picture of him seeing it, you're just left with no one saying he saw it or didn't see it. There's no proof one way or the other, so that's not a factual dispute. I see that I've run out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just the jury or questions right now in terms of, number one, the evidence in terms of the jail call, I think that there was video recordings of the jail. They preserved one video that, again, I found by actually going and having to look at the blood draw facility, because I want to inspect it, and effectively asking the jail supervisor, you know, do you guys record these things? You know, obviously we could see a lot of happen if they're recorded. She goes, oh yeah, we record those all the time. No one knew, evidently, at the district attorney's office, that these existed. But there's potentially videos of everything. This is not some misdemeanor, and this is also someone being arrested. This is not I'm coming in here and I'm just gonna chill and look around. This is a very stressful situation. And one sign in a very stressful situation is not meaningful notice. When you're not stressed when you pull into that parking lot, the shopping mall, and see the towing sign. You're bebopping in and see, oh, yep, if I'm supposed to be here, I'm supposed to be here. You know, like, stress is a funny thing that plays different roles on different people. So there was evidence to show that should have gone to the jury regarding the phone call. Was there meaningful notice? And there was no evidence that Adil saw, Mr. Steek saw the sign. The issue on the blood draw, the state contends that everything was done reasonable, that everything was done properly. But there was mounting direct evidence from the defense that indeed no proper medical procedure was followed. But the defense, the state's, the appellee's witness said, finally had to admit, I didn't follow proper medical procedure. But the appellant didn't stop there. He then called the head of phlebotomy at Denton Regional Hospital to say in front of the jury, she did not follow proper medical procedure. These are the several things I see wrong with this blood draw. Therefore, there was a material issue of fact as to reasonableness of the blood draw. It would be great to have something from the legislature or the court saying, if you're going to record these conversations, you need to put a warning sign on the phone, there needs to be a prompt on the phone, there needs to be signs, more than one sign, throughout the jail. But unfortunately, it's going to take the courts, it sounds like, to do that. We have the wiretap statute. It is applicable here. The state never said it wasn't. They just said this one sign above the door. But again, there isn't applied consent. That would be the meaningful notice. And we don't have that here. The issue in terms of what Officer Knight testified to, if you look at the record, the phone call was already admitted when Officer Knight testified regarding what he heard. We've had numerous arguments with the court. The court ruled that it was admissible. So when Officer Knight testified to what was on it, it was already in evidence. It already been admitted to evidence. Discovery was a huge issue in this case. But again, I think that what really is shocking in this case is the state would try to produce a blood result that they didn't produce any evidence that was unreasonable. That their own blood draw person showed up with notes the day of trial she didn't produce before, that she testified that she got the certificate, that she went online for continuing education. The certificate comes from Kansas. Your barber has to have a license to cut your hair, but we have no licensing for people who draw blood in this state. It's kind of a funny concept that someone who wants to cut your hair has to have a license, but the person drawing your blood to go to court does not. One of the issues the state wanted to point on is that the defense needs to show a harm, which we don't think we do. We think the burden relies on the state. Once we show that reasonableness wasn't met, the burden is strongly on the state's shoulders to show why it was reasonable, but they want to say, well, he wasn't actually hurt. This is not a result-oriented thing. This isn't, oh, he got hurt, so something must have went wrong. Again, he doesn't have the option of saying who gets to draw his blood or if that person's qualified. The reasonableness, we don't look at see if search and seizure, what was found, to determine was the search reasonable or not. We have to look at its inception, what happened, and what procedures were followed. Here, very few procedures were followed regarding the blood draw. And this court has said, had concerns before regarding blood draws in jails. One of the issues the state says, well, it was sanitary. It was a sanitary place. Yet they turned over no records to show it was sanitary, even though they said they keep logs of records, or logs of the cleaning records. And in fact, the defense showed at trial that there were no records, even though their witnesses testified other way. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. It's been very helpful. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business. And this court will be, I guess, in recess until this afternoon. And we'll be adjourned.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeals of the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.